8. Taming Nature, an Agriculture of Legibility and Simplicity. Yes, enumerate the carriage parts, still not a carriage. When you begin making decisions and cutting it up, rules and names appear, and once names appear, you should know when to stop. Tao Te Ching. The necessarily simple abstractions of large bureaucratic institutions, as we have seen, can never adequately represent the actual complexity of natural or social processes. The categories that they employ are too coarse, too static, and too stylized to do justice to the world that they purport to describe. For reasons that will become apparent, state-sponsored high-modernist agriculture has recourse to abstractions of the same order. The simple production and profit model of agricultural extension and agricultural research has failed in important ways to represent the complex, supple, negotiated objectives of real farmers and their communities. That model has also failed to represent the space in which farmers plant crops, its microclimates, its moisture and water movement, its micro-relief, and its local biotic history. Unable to effectively represent the profusion and complexity of real farms and real fields, high modernist agriculture has often succeeded in radically simplifying those farms and fields so they can be more directly apprehended, controlled, and managed. I emphasize the radical simplification of agricultural high modernism because agriculture is, even in its most rudimentary Neolithic forms, inevitably a process of simplifying the floral profusion of nature. How else are we to understand the process by which man has encouraged certain species of flora that he found useful and discouraged others that he found a nuisance? The logic behind the radical simplification of the field is almost precisely identical to the logic behind the radical simplification of the forest. In fact, a simplified agriculture, which was developed earlier, served as the model for scientific forestry. The guiding idea was the maximization of the crop yield or profit. The forests were reconceptualized as timber farms, in which a single species of tree was planted in straight rows and harvested like a crop when it was mature. The preconditions of such simplifications were the existence of a commodity market and competitive pressure on states as well as entrepreneurs to maximize profits or revenue. In the monocropped field and single species forest alike, the innumerable other members of the biotic community were ignored unless they had some direct bearing on the health and yield of the species to be harvested. Such narrowing of attention to a single outcome, invariably the one of most commercial or fiscal interest, confers an analytical power that allows foresters and agronomists to track carefully the influence of other factors on this single dependent variable. Within its ambit, there is no denying the extraordinary power of this approach to increase yields. As we shall see, however, this potent but narrow perspective is troubled both by certain inevitable blind spots and by phenomena that lie outside its restricted field of vision. To continue the metaphor, this narrowness in turn means that production agronomy is occasionally blindsided by factors outside its analytical focus and is forced, by the resulting crisis, to take a broader perspective. The question we shall address in this chapter is why a model of modern scientific agriculture that has apparently been successful in the temperate, industrializing West has so often foundered in the Third World. In spite of these indifferent results, the model has been pressed by colonial modernizers, independent states, and international agencies. In Africa, where the results have been particularly sobering, an agronomist with great experience has claimed that one of the crucial lessons of the past 50 years or so of ecological research focused on African agriculture is that the dramatic modernization option has a track record so poor that a return to slower and more incremental approaches must now be given serious and sustained attention. We will not be much concerned in this discussion with the particular reasons that made this scheme or that cropping plan fail. To be sure, the familiar bureaucratic pathologies as well as openly predatory practices have often greatly compounded these failures. My claim, however, is that the origin of these failures can be traced to a deeper level. These were, in other words, systemic failures, and would have occurred under the best assumptions about administrative efficiency and probity. At least four elements seem to be at work in these systemic failures. The first two are linked to the historical origin and institutional nexus of high modernist agriculture. First, given their discipline's origin in the temperate, industrializing West, the bearers of modernism in agricultural planning inherited a series of unexamined assumptions about cropping and field preparation that turned out to work badly in other contexts. Second, given the presumptions about expertise embodied in modernist agricultural planning, the actual schemes were continually bent to serve the power and status of officials and of the state organs they controlled. The third element, however, operates at a deeper level. It is the systematic, cyclopean short-sightedness of high modernist agriculture that courts certain forms of failure. Its rigorous attention to productionist goals casts into relative obscurity all the outcomes lying outside the immediate relationship between farm inputs and yields. This means that both long-term outcomes, soil structure, water quality, land tenure relations, and third-party effects, or what welfare economists call externalities, receive little attention until they begin to affect production. Finally, the very strength of scientific agricultural experimentation, its simplifying assumptions, and its ability to isolate the impact of a single variable on total production, is incapable of dealing adequately with certain forms of complexity. It tends to ignore or discount agricultural practices that are not assimilable to its techniques. Lest there be any misunderstanding about my purpose here, I want to emphasize that this is not a general offensive against modern agronomic science, let alone an attack on the culture of scientific research. Modern agronomic science, with its sophisticated plant breeding, plant pathology, analysis of plant nutrition, soil analysis, and technical virtuosity, is responsible for creating a fund of technical knowledge that is by now being used in some form by even the most traditional cultivators. My purpose, rather, is to show how the imperial pretensions of agronomic science, its inability to recognize or incorporate knowledge created outside its paradigm, sharply limited its utility to many cultivators. Whereas farmers, as we shall see, seem pragmatically alert to knowledge coming from any quarter should it serve their purposes, modern agricultural planners are far less receptive to other ways of knowing. Varieties of agricultural simplification. Early agriculture. Cultivation is simplification. Even the most cursory forms of agriculture typically produce a floral landscape that is less diverse than an unmanaged landscape. The crops that mankind has cultivated have, when fully domesticated, become dependent for their survival upon the management of cultivators, such activities as making a clearing, burning brush, breaking the soil, weeding, pruning, manuring. Strictly speaking, a crop in the field is not an artificial landscape, inasmuch as all fauna, not excluding human beings, modify their environment in the course of food gathering. What is certain, however, is that most of Homo sapiens cultivars have been so adapted to their altered landscape that they have become biological monsters, which could not survive in the wild. Millennia of variation and conscious human selection have favored cultivars that are systematically different from their wild and weedy cousins. Our convenience has led us to prefer plants that have large seeds and are easy to germinate, have more blossoms and hence more fruit, and whose fruits are more easily threshed or shelled. Cultivated maize thus has a few large ears with large kernels, whereas wild or semi-domesticated mazes have very small cobs with small kernels. The difference is most starkly captured by the contrast between the huge seed-laden commercial sunflower and its diminutive woodland relative. Beyond the question of the harvest itself, of course, cultivators have also selected for scores of other properties: texture, flavor, color, storage quality, aesthetic value, grinding and cooking qualities, and so on. The breadth of human purposes has led not to a single ideal cultivar of each species, but rather to a great many varieties, each distinctive in some important way. Thus we have the varieties of barley grown for porridge, for bread, for beer, and for feeding livestock. And thus sweet sorghum for chewing, white-seeded types for bread, small dark red-seeded types for beer, and strong-stemmed fibrous types for house construction and basketry. The greatest selection pressure, however, came from the dominant anxiety of cultivators that they not starve. This most basic of existential concerns also led to a great variety of cultivars, termed the land races of the various crops. Land races are genetically variable populations that respond differently to different soil conditions, levels of moisture, temperature, sunlight, diseases and pests, microclimates, and so forth. Over time, traditional cultivators, operating as experienced applied botanists, have developed literally thousands of land races of a single species. A working knowledge of many, if not all, of these land races provided cultivators with enormous flexibility in the face of environmental factors that they could not control. For our purposes, the long development of so many land races is significant in at least two respects. First, while early farmers were transforming and simplifying their natural environment, they also had a surpassing interest in fostering a certain kind of diversity. A combination of their wide interests and their concern about the food supply impelled them to select and protect many land races. The genetic variability of the crops they grew provided some built-in insurance against drought, flooding, plant diseases, pests, and the seasonal vagaries of climate. A pathogen might affect one land race, but not another. Some land races would do well in a drought, others in wet conditions. Some would do well in clay soil, others in sandy soil. Placing a large number of prudent bets, finely tuned to micro-local conditions, the cultivator maximized the dependability of a tolerable harvest. The variety of land races is significant in another sense. All modern crops of any economic significance are the product of land races. Until about 1930, all scientific crop breeding was essentially a process of selection from among the existing land races. Land races and their wild progenitors and escapes represent the germplasm or seed stock capital upon which modern agriculture is based. In other words, as James Boyce has put it, modern varieties and traditional agriculture are complements, not substitutes. 20th Century Agriculture. Modern industrial scientific farming, which is characterized by monocropping, mechanization, hybrids, the use of fertilizers and pesticides, and capital intensiveness, has brought about a level of standardization into agriculture that is without historical precedent. Far beyond mere monocropping on the model of scientific forestry explored earlier, this simplification has entailed a genetic narrowing fraught with consequences that we are only beginning to comprehend. One of the basic sources of increasing uniformity in crops arises from the intense commercial pressures to maximize profits in a competitive mass market. Thus, the effort to increase planting densities in order to stretch the productivity of land encouraged the adoption of varieties that would tolerate crowding. Greater planting densities have in turn intensified the use of commercial fertilizers and therefore the selection of subspecies known for high fertilizer, especially nitrogen, uptake and response. At the same time, the growth of great supermarket chains with their standardized routines of shipping, packaging and display has inexorably led to an emphasis on uniformity of size, shape, color, and eye appeal. The result of these pressures was to concentrate on the small number of cultivars that met these criteria, while abandoning others. The production of uniformity in the field is best grasped, however, through the logic of mechanization. As factor prices in the West have, since at least 1950, favored the substitution of farm machinery for hired labor, the farmer has sought cultivars that were compatible with mechanization. That is, he selected crops whose architecture did not interfere with tractors or sprayers, which ripened uniformly, and which could be picked in a once-over pass of the machine. Given the techniques of hybridization being developed at roughly the same time, it was but a short step to creating new crop varieties bred explicitly for mechanization. Genetic variability, as Jack Ralph Kloppenberg notes, is the enemy of mechanization. In the case of corn, hybridization, the progeny of two inbred lines, produces a field of the genetically identical individuals that are ideal for mechanization. Varieties developed with machinery in mind were available as early as 1920, when Henry Wallace joined forces with a manufacturer of harvesting equipment to cultivate his new stiff-stalked variety with a strong shank connecting the ear to the stalk. An entire field of plant breeding termed phytoengineering was thus born in order to adapt the natural world to machine processing. Machines are not made to harvest crops, noted two proponents of phytoengineering. In reality, crops must be designed to be harvested by machine. Having been adapted to the cultivated field, the crop was now adapted to mechanization. The machine-friendly crop was bred to incorporate a series of characteristics that made it easier to harvest it mechanically. Among the most important of these characteristics were resilience, a concentrated fruit set, uniformity of plant size and architecture, uniformity of fruit shape and size, dwarfing, in the case of tree crops especially, and fruits that easily break away from the plant. The development of the supermarket tomato by G.C. Jack Hanna at the University of California at Davis in the late 1940s and 1950s is an early and diagnostic case. Spurred by the wartime shortage of field labor, researchers set about inventing a mechanical harvester and breeding the tomato that would accommodate it. The tomato plants eventually bred for the job were hybrids of low stature and uniform maturity that produced similarly sized fruits with thick walls, firm flesh, and no cracks. The fruits were picked green in order to avoid being bruised by the grasp of the machinery and were artificially ripened by ethylene gas during transport. The results were the small uniform winter tomatoes, sold four to a package, which dominated supermarket shelves for several decades. Taste and nutritional quality were secondary to machine compatibility. Or to put it more charitably, the breeders did what they could to develop the best tomato within the very sharp constraints of mechanization. The imperatives of maximizing profits, and hence, in this case, of mechanizing the harvest, worked powerfully to transform and simplify both the field and the crop. Relatively inflexible, non-selective machines work best in flat fields with identical plants growing uniform fruits of perfectly even maturity. Agronomic science was deployed to approximate this ideal. Large, finely graded fields, uniform irrigation and nutrients to regulate growth, liberal use of herbicides, fungicides, and insecticides to maintain uniform health, and, above all, plant breeding to create the ideal cultivar. The unintended consequences of simplification. Reviewing the history of major crop epidemics, beginning with the Irish potato famine in 1850, a committee of the United States National Research Council concluded, "These encounters show clearly that crop monoculture and genetic uniformity invite epidemics. All that is needed is the arrival on the scene of a parasite that can take advantage of the vulnerability. If the crop is uniformly vulnerable, so much the better for the parasite. In this way, virus diseases have devastated sugar beets with yellows, peaches with yellows, potatoes with leaf roll and X and Y viruses, cocoa with swollen shoot, clover with sudden death, sugarcane with mosaic, and rice with hoja blanca." After a corn leaf blight had devastated much of the 1970 corn crop, the committee had been convened in order to consider the genetic vulnerability of all major crops. One of the pioneer breeders of hybrid corn, Donald Jones, had foreseen the problems that the loss of genetic diversity might bring. "Genetically uniform pure-line varieties are very productive and highly desirable when environmental conditions are favorable and the varieties are well protected from pests of all kinds. When these external factors are not favorable, the result can be disastrous due to some new virulent parasite." The logic of epidemiology in crops is relatively straightforward in principle. All plants have some resistance to pathogens, otherwise they and the pathogen, if it preyed upon only that plant, would disappear. At the same time, all plants are genetically vulnerable to certain pathogens. If a field is populated exclusively by genetically identical individuals, such as single cross hybrids or clones, then each plant is vulnerable in exactly the same way to the same pathogen, be it a virus, fungus, bacterium, or nematode. Such a field is an ideal genetic habitat for the proliferation of precisely those strains or mutants of pathogens that thrive and feed on this particular cultivar. The uniform habitat, especially one in which plants are crowded, exerts a natural selection pressure, as it were, that favors such pathogens. Given the right seasonal conditions for the pathogen to multiply, temperature, humidity, wind, and so on, the classic conditions for the geometric progression of an epidemic are in place. In contrast, diversity is the enemy of epidemics. In a field with many species of plants, only a few individuals are likely to be susceptible to a given pathogen, and they are likely to be widely scattered. The mathematical logic of the epidemic is broken. A monocropped field, as the National Research Council report noted, increases vulnerability appreciably inasmuch as all members of the same plant species share much of their genetic inheritance. But where a field is populated by many genetically diverse land races of a given species, the risk is vastly reduced. Any agricultural practice that increases diversity over time and space, such as crop rotation or mixed cropping on a farm or in a region, acts as a barrier to the spread of epidemics. The modern regime of pesticide use, which has arisen over the past 50 years, must be seen as an integral feature of this genetic vulnerability, not as an unrelated scientific breakthrough. It is precisely because hybrids are so uniform and hence disease-prone that quasi-heroic measures have to be taken to control the environment in which they are grown. Such hybrids are analogous to a human patient with a compromised immune system who must be kept in a sterile field lest an opportunistic infection take hold. The sterile field in this case has been established by the blanket use of pesticides. Corn, as the most widely planted crop in the United States, 85 million acres in 1986, and the first one to be hybridized, has provided nearly ideal conditions for insect, disease, and weed buildup. Pesticide use is correspondingly high. Corn accounts for 1/3 of the total market for herbicides and 1/4 of the market for insecticides. One of the long-term effects, which is readily predictable according to the theory of natural selection, has been the emergence of resistant strains among insects, fungi, and weeds, necessitating either larger doses or a new set of chemical agents. Some pathogens, again predictably, have developed what is termed cross-resistance to a whole class of pesticides. As more generations of the pathogen are exposed to the pesticide, the likelihood that resistant strains will emerge is correspondingly greater. Above and beyond the troubling consequences of pesticide use for the organic matter in the soil, groundwater quality, human health, and the ecosystem, pesticides have exacerbated some existing crop diseases while creating new ones. Just prior to the cornleaf blight in the South in 1970, 71% of all acreage in corn was planted to only 6 hybrids. The specialists investigating the blight stressed the pressures of mechanization and product uniformity that led to a radically narrower genetic crop base. Uniformity, the report asserted, is the key word. Most of the hybrids have been developed by the male sterile method using Texas cytoplasm. It was this uniformity that was attacked by the fungus Helminthosporium maidus. Those hybrids created without Texas cytoplasm suffered only trivial damage. The pathogen was not new. In its report, the National Research Council Committee imagined that it was probably in existence when Squanto showed the pilgrims how to plant corn. While H. maidus may have from time to time produced more virulent strains, American corn was too variable to give the new strain a very good foothold. What was new was the vulnerability of the host. The report went on to document the fact that most major crops are impressively uniform genetically and impressively vulnerable to epidemics. Exotic germplasm from a rare Mexican landrace proved to be the solution to breeding new hybrids that were less susceptible to the blight. In this and many other cases, it was only the genetic diversity created by a long history of landrace development by non-specialists that provided a way out. Like the formal order of the planned section of Brasilia, or collectivized agriculture, modern, simplified, and standardized agriculture depends for its existence on a dark twin of informal practices and experience on which it is, ultimately, parasitic. The Catechism of High Modernist Agriculture. The model and promise of American agricultural modernism was absolutely hegemonic in the three decades from 1945 to 1975. It was the prevailing export model. Hundreds of irrigation and dam projects, modeled roughly on the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA, were begun. Many large and highly capitalized agricultural schemes were inaugurated with great fanfare, and thousands of advisors were dispatched. There was a continuity in personnel as well as in ideas. Economists, engineers, agronomists, and planners who had served in the TVA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or the Department of the Treasury, moved to the United Nations, the Food and Agriculture Organization, or USAID, bringing their experience and ideas with them. A combination of American political, economic, and military hegemony, the promise of loans and assistance, concerns about world population and food supply, and the great productivity of American agriculture made for a degree of self-confidence in the American model that is hard to overestimate. A few skeptics, like Rachel Carson, were beginning to question the model, but they were greatly outnumbered by a chorus of visionaries who saw an unlimited and brilliant future ahead. Typical of the optimism was an article by James B. Billard, entitled More Food for Our Multiplying Millions, The Revolution in American Agriculture, which appeared in a 1970 issue of National Geographic. Its vision of the farm of the future was not an idle fantasy. It was, we are told, drawn with the guidance of U.S. Department of Agriculture specialists. The caption details the farm of the early 21st century. Grain fields stretch like fairways, and cattle pens resemble high-rise apartments. Attached to a modernistic farmhouse, a bubble-topped control tower hums with a computer, weather reports, and a farm price ticker tape. A remote-controlled tiller combine glides across the 10-mile-long wheat field on tracks that keep the heavy machinery from compacting the soil. Threshed grain, funneled into a pneumatic tube beside the field, flows into storage elevators rising close to a distant city. The same machine that cuts the grain prepares the land for another crop. A similar device waters neighboring strips of soybeans as a jet-powered helicopter sprays insecticides. Across a service road, conical mills blend feed for beef cattle, fattening in multi-level pens that conserve ground space. Tubes carry the feed to be mechanically distributed. A central elevator transports the cattle up and down, while a tubular side drain flushes wastes to be broken down for fertilizer. Beside the farther pen, a processing plant packs beef into cylinders for shipment to market by helicopter and monorail. Illuminated plastic domes provide controlled environments for growing high-value crops such as strawberries, tomatoes, and celery. Near a distant lake and recreation area, a pumping station supplies water for the vast operation. Billard's text is one long paean to mechanization, scientific marvels, and huge scale. For all the technical wizardry, he envisions a process of simplification of the landscape and centralization of command. Fields will be larger, with fewer trees, hedges, and roads. Plots may be several miles long and 100 yards wide. Weather control will prevent hailstorms and tornadoes. Atomic energy will level hills and make irrigation water from seawater. Satellites, sensors, and airplanes will spot plant epidemics while the farmer sits in his control tower. At the operational level, the credo of American agriculture for export incorporated the same fundamental convictions. Both the exporters and the vast majority of their eager clients were committed to the following truths: the superior technical efficiency of large-scale farms, the importance of mechanization to save labor and break technical bottlenecks, the superiority of monocropping and hybrids over polycropping and land races, and the advantages of high-input agriculture, including commercial fertilizers and pesticides. Above all, they believed in large, integrated, planned projects rather than piecemeal improvements, partly because the large, capital-intensive schemes could be planned as nearly pure technical exercises, rather like the design of the Soviet collective farm that was invented in a Chicago hotel room. The greater the industrial content of a scheme and the more its environment could be made uniform through controlled irrigation and nutrients, the use of tractors and combines, the development of flat fields, the less was left to chance. Local soils, local landscape, local labor, local implements, and local weather appeared to be almost irrelevant to the prepackaged projects. At the same time, schemes conceived along these lines emphasized the technical expertise of the planners, the possibility of central control, and, not least, a module that could be redeployed to almost any locale. For local elites anxious to have a modern show project over which they could preside, the advantages were also obvious. The lamentable fate of the vast majority of these projects, whether private or public, is by now a matter of record. They failed in most cases despite lavish credit subsidies and strong administrative backing. While each failure had its own peculiarities, the level of abstraction at which most projects were conceived was fatal. Imported faith and abstraction prevailed, as we shall see, over close attention to the local context. Modernist faith versus local practices. We can explore the contrast between imported faith and local context by juxtaposing several tenets of the catechism of high modernist agriculture with the local practices that appeared to violate them. And as we shall see, contrary to contemporary expectations, these practices turned out to be scientifically sound and in some cases superior to the program of farming being urged or imposed by the agricultural reformers. Monoculture and polyculture. Nothing better illustrates the myopic credo of high modernist agriculture, originating in temperate zones and brought to the tropics, than its nearly unshakable faith in the superiority of monoculture over the practice of polyculture found in much of the Third World. To take West African indigenous farming systems as an example, colonial agricultural specialists encountered what seemed to them to be an astonishingly diverse regime of polycropping, with as many as four crops, not to mention subspecies, in the same field simultaneously. A fairly representative instance of what met their eyes is depicted in a picture of a construction of stickbuns across incipient gullies in a Sierra Leone rice field. The visual effect, to Western eyes, was one of sloppiness and disorder. Given their visual codification of modern agricultural practice, most specialists knew, without further empirical investigation, that the apparent disorder of the crops was a system of backward techniques. It failed the visual test of scientific agriculture. Campaigns to replace polyculture with pure stand planting were pushed with equal fervor by colonial officials and, after independence, by their local successors. We have gradually come to understand a quite specific logic of place, in particular, tropical soils, climate, and ecology, that helps to explain the functions of polyculture. The diversity of species naturally occurring in a tropical setting is, other things being equal, consistently greater than the diversity of species in a temperate setting. An acre of tropical forest will have far more species of plants, although fewer individuals of each species, than will an acre of temperate woodland. Thus, unmanaged nature in temperate climates looks more orderly because it is less diverse, and this may play a role in the visual culture of Westerners. In favoring polyculture, the tropical cultivator also imitates nature in his techniques of cultivation. Polyculture, like the tropical forest itself, plays an important role in protecting thin soils from the erosive effects of wind, rain, and sunlight. Furthermore, the seasonality of tropical agriculture is governed more by the timing of rains than by temperature. For this reason, a variety of polycropping strategies allows farmers to hedge their bets against the rains, holding the soil with drought-resistant crops, and interspersing among them crops that can take best advantage of the rains. Finally, the creation of a uniform controlled farming environment is intrinsically more difficult in a tropical setting than in a temperate one, and where population densities are low, the labor requirements of extensive terracing or irrigation are uneconomic in the strict neoclassical sense of the word. Here one may recall Jane Jacobs's important distinction between visual orderliness on one hand and functional working order on the other. The city desk of a newspaper, a rabbit's intestines, or the interior of an aircraft engine may certainly look messy, but each one reflects, sometimes brilliantly, an order related to the function it performs. In such instances, the apparent surface disarray obscures a more profound logic. Polyculture was a floral variant of such order. Only a very few colonial specialists managed to peer behind the visual confusion to its logic. One of them was Howard Jones, a mycologist in Nigeria, who wrote in 1936, "To the European, the whole scheme seems laughable and ridiculous, and in the end he would probably conclude that it is merely foolish to crowd different plants together in this childish way so that they may choke one another. Yet if one looks at it more closely, there seems a reason for everything. The plants are not growing at random, but have been planted at proper distances on hillocks of soil arranged in such a way that when rain falls, it does not waterlog the plants, nor does it pour off the surface and wash away the fine soil. The soil is always occupied and is neither dried up by the sun nor leached out by the rain, as it would be if it were left bare. This is but one of many examples that might be given that should warn us to be very cautious and thorough before we pass judgment upon native agriculture. The whole method of farming and outlook of the farmer are so entirely new to us that we are strongly tempted to call it foolish from an instinctive conservatism." Elsewhere in the tropical world, a few astute observers were uncovering a different agricultural logic. A striking example of visual order versus working order was provided by Edgar Anderson on the basis of his botanical work in rural Guatemala. He realized that what appeared to be overgrown, riotous dump heaps that no Westerner would have taken for gardens exhibited, on closer inspection, an exceptionally efficient and well-thought-out order. Anderson sketched one of these gardens, and his description of the logic he discerned in it is worth quoting at length. "Though at first sight there seems little order, as soon as we started mapping the garden we realized that it was planted in fairly definite crosswise rows. There were fruit trees, native and European, in great variety, anonas, cherimoyas, avocados, peaches, quinces, plums, a fig, and a few coffee bushes. There were giant cacti grown for their fruit. There was a large plant of rosemary, a plant of rue, some poinsettias, and a fine semi-climbing tea rose. There was a whole row of the native domesticated hawthorn, whose fruits, like yellow doll-sized apples, make a delicious conserve. There were two varieties of corn, one well past bearing and now serving as a trellis for climbing string beans, which were just coming into season, the other a much taller sort, which was tasseling out. There were specimens of a little banana with smooth, wide leaves, which are the local substitute for wrapping paper, and are also used instead of corn husks in cooking the native variant of hot tamales. Over it all clambered the luxuriant vines of the various cucurbits. Chayote, when finally mature, has a large nutritious root weighing several pounds. At one point there was a depression the size of a small bathtub where a chayote root had recently been excavated. This served as a dump heap and compost for the waste from the house. At one end of the garden was a small beehive made from boxes and tin cans. In terms of our American and European equivalents, the garden was a vegetable garden, an orchard, a medicinal garden, a dump heap, a compost heap, and a bee yard. There was no problem of erosion, though it was at the top of a steep slope. The soil surface was practically all covered and apparently would be during most of the year. Humidity would be kept during the dry season, and plants of the same sort were so isolated from one another by intervening vegetation that pests and diseases could not readily spread from plant to plant. The fertility was being conserved. In addition to the waste from the house, mature plants were being buried in between the rows when their usefulness was over. It is frequently said by Europeans and European Americans that time means nothing to an Indian. This garden seemed to me to be a good example of how the Indian, when we look more than superficially into his activities, is budgeting his time more efficiently than we do. The garden was in continuous production, but was taking only a little effort at any one time. A few weeds pulled when one came down to pick the squashes, corn and bean plants dug in between the rows when the last of the climbing beans were picked, and a new crop of something else planted above them a few weeks later. Like the micro-logic of the Guatemalan garden, the logic of West African polycropping systems, long dismissed as being primitive, has finally been recognized. In fact, they came under investigation partly as a reaction against the many monocropping schemes that miscarried. The advantages were often evident even at the level of narrow productivist outcomes, and once other goals, such as sustainability, conservation, and food security were considered, their advantages seemed especially striking. Various forms of polyculture are the norm in 80% of West Africa's farmland. Given what we now know, this should occasion little surprise. Intercropping systems are best adapted to soils of low fertility, which characterize much of West Africa. Their use produces greater gains in yield on such soils than on soils of high fertility. One reason seems to be that optimal planting densities are greater in intercropping than in monocropping, and the resulting crowding appears, for reasons that are poorly understood but may have to do with root fungi interactions, to improve the performance of each cultivar. Crowding at the later stage of cropping also helps to suppress weeds, which are otherwise a major constraint in tropical farming. Since the mixture of cultivars usually combines grains and legumes, maize and sorghum, for example, with cowpeas and groundnuts, each crop has complementary nutritional needs and rooting systems that extract nutrients from different levels in the soil. In the case of relay cropping, it appears that the residues of the first crop gathered benefit the remaining crop. The diversity of cultivars on the same field also has a beneficial effect on the health of the crops and hence on yields. Mixed crops and the scattering of particular cultivars limit the habitat of various pests, diseases, and weeds that might otherwise build up to devastating proportions as they do on monocropped plots. In fact, two specialists who were very much out of step with the agronomic establishment of the 1930s and 1940s went so far as to suggest that the systematic study of mixed cropping and other native practices might lead to comparatively minor modifications in Yoruba and other forms of agriculture, which might in the aggregate do more to increase crop production and soil fertility than revolutionary changes to green manuring or mixed farming. The multi-storied effect of polyculture has some distinct advantages for yields and soil conservation. Upper-story crops shade lower-story crops, which are selected for their ability to thrive in the cooler soil temperature and increased humidity at ground level. Rainfall reaches the ground not directly, but as a fine spray that is absorbed with less damage to soil structure and less erosion. The taller crops often serve as a useful windbreak for the lower crops. Finally, in mixed or relay cropping, a crop is in the field at all times, holding the soil together and reducing the leaching effects that sun, wind, and rain exert, particularly on fragile land. Even if polyculture is not to be preferred on the grounds of immediate yield, there is much to recommend it in terms of sustainability and thus long-term production. Our discussion of mixed cropping has thus far dealt only with the narrow issues of yield and soil conservation. It has overlooked the cultivators themselves and the various other ends that they seek by using such techniques. The most significant advantage of intercropping, Paul Richards claims, is its great flexibility. The scope it offers for a range of combinations to match individual needs and preferences, local conditions and changing circumstances within each season and from season to season. Farmers may polycrop in order to avoid labor bottlenecks at planting and at harvest. Growing many different crops is also an obvious way to spread risks and improve food security. Cultivators can reduce the danger of going hungry if they sow, instead of only one or two cultivars, crops of long and short maturity, crops that are drought-resistant and those that do well under wetter conditions, crops with different patterns of resistance to pests and diseases, crops that can be stored in the ground with little loss, such as cassava, and crops that mature in the hungry time before other crops are gathered. Finally, and perhaps most important, each of these crops is embedded in a distinctive set of social relations. Different members of the household are likely to have different rights and responsibilities with respect to each crop. The planting regimen, in other words, is a reflection of social relations, ritual needs, and culinary tastes. It is not just a production strategy that a profit-maximizing entrepreneur took straight out of the pages of a text in neoclassical economics. The high modernist aesthetic and ideology of most colonial agronomists and their Western-trained successors foreclosed a dispassionate examination of local cultivation practices, which were regarded as deplorable customs for which modern scientific farming was the corrective. A critique of such hegemonic ideas comes, if it comes at all, not from within, but typically from the margins, where the intellectual point of departure and operating assumptions, as was the case with Jacobs, are substantially different. Thus, the case for the rationality of mixed cropping has largely come from rogue figures outside the establishment. Perhaps the most striking of these figures was Albert Howard, later Sir Albert, an agricultural researcher who worked under local patronage for more than 3 decades in India. He was known chiefly for the indoor process, a scientific procedure of making humus from organic wastes, and unlike most Western agronomists, he was an avid observer of forest ecology and indigenous practices. Concerned above all with soil fertility and sustainable agriculture, Howard observed that the natural diversity of the forest and local polycropping practices were both successful means of maintaining or increasing soil health and fertility. Soil fertility was a matter of not simply chemical composition, but also structural properties. The soil's tilth, or crumb structure, its degree of aeration, its moisture-holding power, and the fungus bridge, the mycorrhizal association necessary to humus creation. Some, but not all, elements in this complex soil interaction could be precisely measured, while others could be recognized by a practiced observer, but not readily measured. Howard undertook elaborate experiments in humus production, soil structure, and plant response, and was able to show field trial yield results superior to those achieved by standard Western practices. His main concern, however, was not with how many bushels of wheat or maize could be gotten from an acre, as with the health and quality of the crops and soil over the long haul. The case for polyculture has worked its way back to the West, although it remains one-voiced by only a tiny minority. Rachel Carson, in her revolutionary book Silent Spring, published in 1962, traced the destructive use of massive doses of pesticides and herbicides to monocropping itself. The problem with insects, she explained, resulted from the devotion of immense acreage to a single crop. Such a system set the stage for explosive increases in specific insect populations. Single-crop farming does not take advantage of the principles by which nature works. It is agriculture as an engineer might conceive it to be. Nature has introduced great variety into the landscape, but man has displayed passion for simplifying it. One important check is a limit on the amount of suitable habitat for each species. Just as Howard believed that monoculture had contributed to the loss of soil fertility and its corrective, the growing use of chemical fertilizers, 260 pounds per acre in the United States in 1970, so Carson argued that monoculture spawned the exploding population of pests and its corrective, the massive application of insecticides, a cure that turned out to be worse than the disease. For these and other reasons, there are at least faint indications that some forms of polycropping might be suitable for Western farmers as well as Africans. This is not the place to attempt to demonstrate the superiority of polyculture over monoculture, nor am I qualified to do so. There is no single, context-free answer to this issue, for answers would depend on any number of variables, including the goals sought, the crops sown, and the micro-settings in which they were planted. What I have tried to demonstrate, however, is that polyculture, even on the narrow production-oriented grounds favored by Western agronomy, merited empirical examination as one among many agricultural strategies. That it was instead dismissed summarily by all but a handful of rogue agronomists is a tribute to the power both of imperialist ideology and of the visual aesthetic of agricultural high modernism. The case of polyculture also raises an issue relevant to both agricultural practice and social structure, an issue that we will ponder at greater length in the remainder of this book: the resilience and durability of diversity. Whatever its other virtues or demerits, polyculture is a more stable, more easily sustainable form of agriculture than monocropping. It is more likely to produce what economists call Hicksian income, income that does not undermine factor endowments, which will permit that income flow to continue indefinitely into the future. Polyculture is, at the same time, more supple and adaptable. That is, it is more easily able to absorb stress and damage without being devastated. Elegant research has recently shown that, at least up to a point, the more cultivars that a given plot has, the more productive and resilient it is. Polyculture, as we have seen, is more resistant to the insults of weather and pests, not to mention more generous in the improvements it effects in the soil. Even if monoculture could be shown to always give superior yields in the short run, polyculture might still be considered to have decisive long-term advantages. The evidence from forestry has some application to agriculture as well. Monocropped forests, like those in Germany and Japan, have led to ecological problems so severe that restoration ecology has been called to the rescue in order to reestablish something approaching the earlier diversity in insects, flora, and fauna necessary to the health of the forest. Here it is worth noting the strong parallel between the case for diversity in cultivation and forestry and the case that Jacobs made for diversity in urban neighborhoods. The more complex the neighborhood, she reasoned, the better it will resist short-term shocks in business conditions and market prices. Diversity, by the same token, provides many potential growth points, which can benefit from new opportunities. A highly specialized neighborhood, by contrast, is like a gambler placing all his bets on one turn of the roulette wheel. If he wins big. If he loses, he may lose everything. For Jacobs, of course, a key point about the diversity of a neighborhood is the human ecology it fosters. The variety of locally available goods and services, and the complex human networks that it makes possible, the foot traffic that promotes safety, the visual interest that an animated and convenient neighborhood provides, all interact to make such a location's advantages cumulative. The diversity and complexity that cause systems of flora to become more durable and resilient work, at another level apparently, to cause human communities to become more nimble and satisfactory. Permanent fields versus shifting cultivation. Most West African farmers practiced some form of shifting cultivation. Variously called slash-and-burn cultivation, swiddening, and rotational bush fallow, shifting cultivation involves the temporary cultivation of a field cleared by cutting and burning most of the vegetation. After being worked for a few years, the field is abandoned for a new plot. Eventually, when new growth has restored the original field to something like its original fertility, it is cultivated again. Polycropping and minimum tillage were often combined with shifting cultivation. Like polycropping, shifting cultivation, as we shall see, turns out to be a rational, efficient, and sustainable technique under the soil, climate, and social conditions where it is generally practiced. Polycropping and shifting cultivation are almost invariably associated. Harold Conklin's early, detailed, and still unsurpassed account of shifting cultivation in the Philippines noted that for a newly cleared plot, the average number of cultivars in a single season was between 40 and 60. At the same time, shifting cultivation is an exceptionally complex and hence quite illegible form of agriculture from the perspective of a sovereign state and its extension agents. The fields themselves are fugitive, going in and out of cultivation at irregular intervals, hardly promising material for a cadastral map. The cultivators themselves, of course, are often fugitive as well, moving periodically to be near their new clearings. Registering or monitoring such populations, let alone turning them into easily accessible taxpayers, is a Sisyphean task. The project of the state and the agricultural authorities, as we saw in the Tanzanian case, was to replace this illegible and potentially seditious space with permanent settlements and permanent, preferably monocropped, fields. Shifting cultivation also gave offense to agricultural modernizers of whatever race because it violated, in almost every respect, their understanding of what modern agriculture had to look like. Early attitudes to shifting cultivation were almost entirely negative, Richards notes. It was a bad system, exploitative, untidy, and misguided. The finely adapted logic of shifting cultivation depended on disturbing the landscape and ecology as little as possible, and mimicking, where it could, many of the symbiotic associations of local plants. This meant that such fields looked far more like unimproved nature than the neatly manicured rectilinear fields that most agricultural officers were used to. The ecological caution of shifting cultivation, in other words, was the reason behind the appearances that so offended development officials. Rotational bush fallow had a good many other advantages that were rarely appreciated. It upheld the physical properties of upland and hill soils, which, once destroyed, were difficult to restore. The rotation itself, where land was abundant, ensured the long-run stability of the practice. Shifting cultivators rarely removed large trees or stumps, a custom that limited erosion and helped the soil structure, but that struck agricultural officials as sloppy and unsightly. With some exceptions, Swidden plots were cultivated by hoe or dibble stick rather than plowed. To westernized agronomists, it appeared that the farmers were merely scratching the surface of their soils out of a deplorable ignorance or sloth. Where they encountered farming systems involving deep plowing and monocropping, they believed they had encountered a more advanced and industrious population. The burning of the brush accumulated in clearing a new Swidden was also condemned as wasteful. After a time, however, both shallow cultivation and burning were found to be highly beneficial. The former preserved the soil, especially in areas of high rainfall, while the latter reduced pest populations and provided valuable nutrients to the crop. Experiments showed, in fact, that burning the brush in the field, rather than hauling it off, contributed to better yields, as did a carefully timed burn. To someone trained to a Western perspective, the total effect of such cultivation practices had backwardness written all over it. Heaps of brush waiting to be burned on unplowed, half-cleared fields littered with stumps and planted with several interspersed crops, none of them sown in straight rows. And yet, as the hard evidence accumulated, it was clear that appearances were deceiving, even in productionist terms. As Richards concludes, the proper test for any practice was whether it worked in the environment concerned, not whether it looked advanced or backward. Testing requires carefully controlled input-output trials. If shallow cultivation on partially cleared land gives better returns relative to the inputs expended than rival systems, and these results can be sustained over time, then the technique is a good one, irrespective of whether it was invented yesterday or 1,000 years ago. Lost in the early blanket condemnations of shifting cultivation was the realization that the practice was deployed in a highly discriminating way by African cultivators. Most farmers combined permanent bottomland cultivation of some kind with Swidden cultivation of the more fragile hillsides, uplands, or forests. Rather than not knowing any better, as was often assumed, most shifting cultivators were familiar with a range of cropping techniques, among which they selected with care. Fertilizer versus fertility. The best fertilizer on any farm is the footsteps of the owner. Confucius. Commercial fertilizers have often been touted as magical inoculations for improving poor soils and raising yields. Extension agents have routinely referred to fertilizers and pesticides as medicine for the soil. The actual results have often been disappointing. Two major reasons for the disappointment are directly relevant to our larger argument. First, recommendations for fertilizer applications are inevitably gross simplifications. Their applicability to any particular field is questionable, since a map of soil classes is likely to overlook an enormous degree of microvariation between and within fields. The conditions under which fertilizers are applied, the dosage, the soil structure, the crops for which they are intended, and the weather immediately prior and subsequent to their application can all greatly influence their uptake and effect. As Richards observes, the unavoidable variation by farm and field requires a more open-ended approach, with, in all probability, farmers doing much of the necessary experimentation for themselves. Second, fertilizer formulas suffer from an analytical narrowness. The formulas themselves derive from the work of a remarkable German scientist, Justus Freiherr von Liebig, who, in a classic manuscript published in 1840, identified the main chemical nutrients present in the soil, and to whom we still owe the current standard fertilizer recipe, NPK. It was a brilliant scientific advance with far-reaching and usually beneficial results. Where it tended to get into trouble, however, was when it posed as imperial knowledge, when it was touted as the way in which all soil deficiencies could be remedied. As Howard and others have painstakingly shown, there are a range of intervening variables, including the physical structure of the soil, aeration, tilth, humus, and the fungus bridge, that greatly influence plant nutrition and soil fertility. Chemical fertilizers can, in fact, so thoroughly oxidize beneficial organic matter as to destroy its crumb structure and contribute to a progressive alkalization and a loss of fertility. The details are less important than the larger point. An effective soil science must not stop at chemical nutrients. It must encompass elements of physics, bacteriology, entomology, and geology, and that is at a minimum. Ideally, then, a practical approach to fertilizers requires simultaneously a general, interdisciplinary knowledge, which a single specialist is unlikely to have, and attention to the particularity of a given field which only the farmer is likely to have. A procedure that blends a purely chemical nutrient perspective with soil classification grids and that leaves the particular field far behind is a recipe for ineffectiveness or even disaster.